This is the Capital Literature Podcast, bringing you investment letters and audio. The Capital Literature Podcast is a CEBITS capital service for the investment community. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All rights belong to the respective owners.
Tolley Moore Investment Partners, Fourth Quarter, 2021. Appendix, Tolley Moore Presentation and Q&A at London Business School. Mark Walker, the title of this talk is Investing is Not as Hard as We Think. That's a bit tongue-in-cheek, it's a provocative title. This is not a presentation about how easy investing is. It's hard. And if any of we professional fund managers would remotely pay attention to the base rate of success in the industry, we wouldn't do what we're doing. Thankfully, a healthy level of hubris prevents us from being rational about that decision. What I want to do is share a bit of my experience in providing a context to help us judge our decision-making and investment management and to assess our prospects for success in the industry. Tolley Moore Investment Partners is a private investment partnership here in London. It invests in a concentrated portfolio of global public equities with the goal of compounding investors' capital over the long term. I spent 5 years in generalist global equity mandates on the buy side, and before that, 5 or 6 years on the sell side working on pan-European telecoms research for Redburn Partners and Goldman Sachs. It's that experience which has given me an overview of the institutional money management industry, how the actors in that industry behave, how they're incentivized, and about several of the behavioral constraints they face in making good investment decisions. Investing is not easy. Only 1 in 13, 1 in 19, and 1 in 23 managers, depending on your investment universe, outperforms their benchmarks. However, what we need is a framework to be able to stay the course in periods of underperformance or other source of self-doubt. We already know investing is hard. I spend time in a reflective, introspective, and self-aware group of value investors across the globe, and we constantly remind ourselves how difficult this industry is. Indeed, spending time with those types of thoughtful, talented investors can lead one to feel like a fraud and to doubt our own beliefs and our capacity to add value for our clients. Therefore, we need a broader context in which to judge our prospects for success. Through my experience of speaking to key decision makers in institutional money management firms on the sell side, I want to present a collection of observations from that experience. There are 8 observations. For each one, I'll give you a flavor of my personal experience. I will discuss why I think certain behavioral constraints are antithetical to good investment practice. I'll highlight some of the literature and the research which provide the outside view of that particular constraint, and then I'll suggest some measures we can take to avoid, and hopefully, exploit those behavioral errors. My first observation concerns a pursuit of informational edge. I saw investment processes led by corporate access where investment managers travel the world trying to find the best investment ideas. They speak to the managers at the companies they own and the companies they look at. And frequently, that's right at the front of an investment process. The first time they are introduced to a company is from the words of a talented salesman in the form of a CEO. What I also saw was this focused effort on building complex and detailed financial models of companies which were predicated on knowing everything about everything, and therefore, having a broad knowledge rather than a deep understanding of some of the key factors that matter in understanding business drivers. This led to an inability to calibrate some of the forecasting errors back into improving our investment processes. What's the problem of this approach? It's that information gathering I saw led to increasing confidence in fund managers' expectations of the future and into sell-side capacity to forecast businesses but not leading to any better accuracy. And whereas the sell-side and their buy-side counterparts undoubtedly have clearly above-average IQs and are well-motivated and are well-incentivized, there's a lot of misdirected intellectual effort in terms of trying to play this difficult game. What does the literature say about this pursuit of informational edge leading to overconfidence? It can have profound consequences. In the investment management industry, it can inflate our perceived valuation of the investments we own, and it has several ramifications outside of investing. Several studies have shown little correlation between confidence and accuracy. One of those is related to a study in which professional horse handicappers estimated the outcome of a series of 10 horse races, with each race having 10 horses. In each subsequent round of the game, they were given more information about the jockeys, about the horses, about their form. And initially, when they were given a small subset of information, they were asked to predict the outcome and to give an estimate of their confidence in the outcome. They closely matched. A random guess would give an outcome probability of 10%. They were accurate about 17% of the time, and their estimation of their confidence was also around 17% of 100%. As the rounds of games went on, they were given more information. Their accuracy stayed roughly flat at about 17%, but their estimated confidence went up massively to 40% to 50%. That study suggests that there are, at best, flat returns to increased information. This problem manifests itself in position sizing in a portfolio. It causes us to dramatically increase the size of our bets. James Montier popularized a study which shows there are diminishing returns to extra information through the mechanism of overloading our cognitive capacities. In his book, Value Investing, he shows a study in which participants were asked to estimate or choose the best car, which can be objectively measured. When they were given just four aspects of the car, they guessed correctly 60% of the time. When they were given 12 aspects, that dropped to 20% of the time. How can we avoid this or exploit it? In terms of corporate access, we need to be cognizant of the sales pitches from CEOs. Consider the role corporate access plays in the investment process. I suggest right at the front of the investment process is not the best place. Give yourself time to carve out independent thinking and study around the business and the industry so you can shape the meeting with management and are more insulated from sales pitches. Conduct work on the handful of drivers you've identified rather than striving to know everything about everything. And construct an investment program with a large opportunity set and a concentrated portfolio. That avoids the temptation to be precise about your estimations of intrinsic value for the companies you own or would like to own. Consider a mental model of equal-weighted portfolios. As investment managers, we like to think our portfolio management skills are strong. But if this overconfidence tendency causes us to inappropriately outsize our bets, then consider a constraint in which we have an equal-weighted portfolio. The second observation is the pursuit of analytical edge. I observed how large money management firms tend to be specialists, either geographically or by sector rather than have generalist mandates. Therefore, sector teams are forced to pick winners and losers within narrow universes. This creates the perception, real or otherwise, of deep intellectual expertise which leads to hubris and a level of certainty which might not be appropriate and is a barrier to probabilistic thinking. It's probabilistic thinking that might help us to reason to be accurate rather than reasoning to be right. This deep self-perceived expertise potentially makes us unreceptive to conversations with people with dissenting opinions. That's a barrier to decision-making. Large asset managers tend to organize themselves in terms of analysts and portfolio managers, where analysts do deep fundamental work on companies and portfolio managers typically do not. Therefore, there's a conviction difference between those two groups. When share prices move around a lot, portfolio managers may lack the conviction to know how to act optimally in the face of that volatility because they haven't organically done the work themselves. In these kinds of large teams in the pursuit of analytical edge, hierarchical structures in larger organizations introduce authority bias. Committee-led decision-making typically slows decision-making and is a form of loss aversion because we cannot act decisively when odds are clearly in our favor. What you often see is investment managers and their counterparts on the sell side who need to sound smart to justify high fee structures. You rarely hear the words, "I don't know when I don't know," is, in most instances, the correct answer. It's a barrier to epistemic humility, which is necessary for good decision-making. These fee structures create the temptation to conceal ignorance rather than to openly acknowledge it. The large teams create the perception of intellectual expertise, which makes us less receptive to perceived non-experts. Large teams increase the complexity of organizations. As you arithmetically add individuals to your investment team, you're geometrically increasing the number of relationships and communication lines between those individuals. You're also making it more difficult for individuals to be more accountable for their work. There are more places to hide. Your ability to discern the difference between luck and skill goes down. The bad news for everyone in this room is that smarter people are worse at combating these behavioral biases. They are better at assembling the information, assembling the narrative in their minds that fits their preconceived ideas. Does the literature support this personal experience? Milgram conducted experiments on authority bias in which participants were asked to administer electric shocks to actors. Half of those participants, in response to a person in a white coat with a clipboard asking them to increase the level of electric shocks, administered what would be fatal electric shocks. This conflicted with participants' personal conscience. Authority is useful in social systems, but it can clearly be a barrier to decision-making. Michael Mauboussin suggests that a quarter of the time, professional decision-makers, including investment managers, calibrate their processes and learn from experience. The rest of the time they do something which feels more like progress, like gathering and analyzing information. There's something called a high PPO effect, which is the highest paid person's opinion. That can be a barrier to evidence-based decision-making. A couple of high-profile examples come from Apple and Amazon. Ron Johnson was a guy who headed Apple retail. He was responsible for the successful rollout of the Apple stores. He left to become CEO of JCPenney. In a nutshell, he created this culture in which people were disincentivized to be skeptics, to dissent. And therefore, no one was willing to question his unsuccessful strategy of rolling out JCPenney stores without testing the retail strategy first. At Amazon, Jeff Bezos became obsessed with a feature of the Fire phone called Dynamic Perspective. Like Johnson at JCPenney, he created an environment in which engineers were unwilling to air their concern about the tactical and financial viability of this feature. If you're in large groups, you could succumb to something called groupthink. There were some Ash conformity experiments conducted, one of which was called Face the Rear. Imagine a scene in an elevator. Of course, nearly everybody faces the door when they ride an elevator. However, in this illustration, four actors entered an elevator in which a non-actor, a naive person, had already entered and took their position facing the door. The four actors all faced the rear after they entered. The naive person tried to maintain his individuality. But little by little, he turned slightly more to the wall. In a second illustration of conformity, a naive person had occupied the elevator facing toward the door, then four actors entered the elevator and faced the rear wall. The naive person conformed by facing the rear wall. During the elevator ride, the actors all turned facing the same side wall. When the elevator door opened to reveal its occupants, everybody had changed positions to face the same side wall, including the naive person. The point in these elevator illustrations is that group pressure is subconsciously strong. Groups are like mind-altering substances. Other studies ask subjects to do a simple task, like to choose which line of three lines is the longest. When the experiment is performed with subjects in isolation, 99% of people get it right. When they're put in a group setting where everyone else is planted and chooses a different option, that rate drops to about 50% or 60%. When those people are interviewed afterwards, they did not say they felt pressure to conform to the group. They said they genuinely believed that was the right answer. How can we exploit this? Investment teams should be constructed with small numbers. Mine is small. I'm a single-person investment committee. Small teams help to retain the accountability of decision-makers and provide for simple communication structures. It should be diverse. If the collective decision of a group is to be wise, individual decisions should be independently reached. The solution for a number of these constraints is to have a large investment universe and a concentrated portfolio, which obviates the need for precise valuation mechanisms. Embrace uncertainty. Be willing to say you don't know. Consider the exercise of being asked to bet on something. If you express an opinion and you were forced to bet on it, to what extent would that calibrate the certainty with which you express that opinion? Embrace the spirit of intellectual generosity with peers. In this business, I have ongoing relationships with peer investment managers. There is no sentiment for shielding our intellectual property. We're there to help one another. We share the belief that execution of a long-term investment strategy is our competitive advantage, not the mere fact that we are long-term investors. Consider the usefulness of anonymous voting mechanisms to avoid authority bias when reaching decisions. Portfolio managers should be analysts, and analysts should be portfolio managers. Everyone is doing the work, and you can have a shared conviction. Consider the incentives of people outside your organization giving you advice. Number 3 is pitchbook mentality. Large asset managers have marketing-led investment strategies. They're trying to create an investment strategy they think will sell. That tends to lead them down a path of having niche investment universes predicated on analytical edge using scuttlebutt or primary research methods which are potentially into better investment returns. But often, they reduce to marketing presentations. I also see all the time proprietary idea generation funnels into marketing presentations in large research teams to advertise their analytical edge. There's also a bias to action. Managers need to feel they are earning their fees by doing stuff. What's the issue? There's an asset gathering imperative in the asset management industry. This is a scalable model. It's tempting to grow assets and rapidly increase the profitability of the business model. This imperative can misalign with the providers of the capital you manage. Our strategy is tailored to the investment manager's temperament and what you think will work rather than what you think will sell. The outside view supports this tendency for action. Goalkeepers facing penalty kicks will dive almost every time, which is at odds with what they should do given where the ball goes. But they just can't stand the potential situation in which they stand still and the ball whizzes by them. If only to avoid embarrassment, there's a bias for action. In some other examples of action bias, some research suggests trading frequency is negatively correlated with returns. Warren Buffett certainly aims to profit from that action bias. If you have an investment management business owned by shareholders or equity owners in a business, there's clearly an obligation to those owners to maximize the profitability of the investment management business. There are ways to enrich the owners of an asset management business that are consistent with compounding the capital of your investors, and there are ways that are inconsistent. An asset gathering imperative is mostly inconsistent. Having managers with high levels of insider ownership in their own funds is consistent. Having a performance fee-led structure is consistent. Number 4 is the folly of forecasting. When I was on the sell side, there was a strong focus in having the most accurate numbers. StarMind collects all the analyst estimates for the companies they cover, and it ranks analysts and investment banks according to the analysts with the most accurate numbers. My firm had the most accurate numbers, but our numbers are still horribly inaccurate. The Ashton Partners study showed virtually everyone in the asset management industry thinks that consensus estimates are important. What's the issue with this? We're not operating in a linear system. In meteorology, if someone opens an umbrella, it doesn't affect the accuracy of the weather forecast. Markets and economies are reflexive systems. They're not like meteorology. If a macroeconomist advocates for raising interest rates because of his expectation that inflation will increase, to what extent is he incorporating the feedback loop of employees asking for higher wages in response to that expectation of high inflation? And the volatility of stocks in the near term certainly makes predicting share price movements exceptionally difficult. The outside view, in a nutshell, suggests strategists cannot predict markets. Macroeconomists can't predict economies. They predicted 2 of the last 150 recessions. Chess, which is a reflexive game materially simpler than an economy or a financial market, has 10 to the 120th possible moves. Dick Toller popularized a game, which was a version of Kane's beauty contest. He asked participants to guess a number between 0 and 100. The person who guessed closer to 2/3 of the answer of the average would win a prize. This is a reflexive model. There's a wide variety of guesses, and there are certain spikes in guesses. A spike occurs at 33, this is a first-level thinker guessing the average guess would be 50 and the 33 guess would be 2/3 of 50. Another spike occurs at 22, this is a second-level thinker. He thinks everyone else will guess 33. Another spike occurs at 15 by third-level thinkers. Finally, there's the Nash equilibrium at 0. Guessing share price movements is difficult. Stock market volatility in the near term is extremely high. If you just play at the end where you lengthen your investment horizon and you're estimating the long-term prospects of businesses and not the short-term movements of their quoted prices, your prospects for a good outcome are better. I suggest that trying to understand and analyze a reflexive complex system such as the financial market is a low return on investment exercise. Better directed intellectual effort is in independent research on the fundamentals of companies. Having a large investment universe and a concentrated portfolio lets you focus on the large gaps between price and value. In this approach, you don't need to find a company with 10% upside and be guessing EPS estimates. My fifth observation is manager/investor misalignment. The observation is that fund managers don't invest in their own funds. Management fees are typically high. Performance fees seem to be justified by this legacy expectation that strategies drive fees rather than any consideration of the power of incentives. The issue is that managers' and investors' fortunes are not aligned. Particularly, managers without insider ownership are much less incentivized to limit the size of their fund or even consider the capacity of their investment strategy, which is a barrier to the time-weighted returns on their portfolios. Two observations emerge from the research. There are potentially no statistical indicators of future performance. Maybe there is one, which is insider ownership. Evidence supports the conclusion that companies, not just investment management firms, outperform businesses that are not founder-led in the long run. How should we avoid the constraint of misalignment? Have skin in the game. Your incentive structure should enrich and reward the managers of capital and for doing a good job with that capital. Your enrichment should, in no small part, come from the compounding of your own capital. It should come from a thoughtful performance fee-led fee structure. Consider the employment of hurdles, so charging a certain performance fee over a hurdle which has the effect of making the early performance cheaper for investors and strong performance more expensive. If the manager does well, the investors do well. There's a debate whether management fees should be charged at all, or whether it's your Buffett partnership fee structure of not having a management fee. The Monish Pabrai fee structure is the ultimate alignment of interest. I'm a subscale emerging manager, and the management fees certainly help me to make stress-free business and investment decisions. If I didn't have a management fee structure and remortgaged my house and made all kinds of personal financial decisions, I would not make good decisions for my investors. Also, tell your partners what's in the portfolio. Be transparent with the economic prospects of the portfolio holding companies. You ultimately want an LP base that can invest countercyclically. They can give you money when the markets are down. The vast majority of investors invest pro-cyclically, and that is a barrier to the sustainability of the money management business model. My sixth observation concerns career risk and loss aversion. There is no shortage of rhetoric in the conversations I have with fund managers and large global asset managers about being a long-term fundamental stock picker in one breath, and with the next breath, asking you what Vodafone's Q3 EPS will be. These fund managers may well have a similar investment philosophy to long-term investors, but their capacity to execute that investment philosophy, their capacity to have an investment process consistent with that philosophy is inhibited by all of these things, by career risk, by short-term capital. All of these fund managers have a big budget, so they spend their big budgets on Bloomberg terminals, which encourages them to look at share prices, to look at near-term news flow, to look at markets, and ultimately to try to predict share price movements. This essentially leads to benchmark hugging. The European Securities and Markets Authority, ESMA, discovered 1 in 6 funds overcharges clients because of benchmark hugging. The Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, estimates over £100 billion of investors' money is in benchmark hugging funds run by apparent active managers. This study essentially shows that by being selective, having a high active share and being long-term, you're already on the path to outperform your benchmark hugging short-term peers. But you need capacity for periods of dislocation from the benchmark. How can we exploit career risk and loss aversion? As an independent emerging management firm, Tullymore has a disadvantage because we're subscale. However, we have an advantage because we can organically build a limited partner base sympathetic with the investment strategy that's intellectually generous, who can have conversations with us about business prospects at the underlying holding companies and not challenge us on why we underperform or overperform over short periods. In a nutshell, our job as investment managers is to tread this line between conviction and dogma. We want the conviction to average down. That helps us outperform if we execute correctly. But we want to have the humility to acknowledge our mistakes. We don't want an environment causing us to conceal our mistakes or our ignorance. The seventh observation concerns short-term capital. Large asset managers with an entrenched LP base are not positioned to improve the quality of the LP base organically. They're stuck with it. Asset gathering mandates have typically led to unidirectional marketing processes, that is, the manager pitches his fund, pitches his ideas to prospective allocators and current investors. That potentially leads to situations in which the investor and manager are incompatible. That can lead to sullied reputations in the investment management business and what is typically the case, procyclical capital flows. You haven't made your loss on your investments permanent until a redemption forces you to crystallize that loss. What's the issue? Short-term capital leads to short-holding periods, and again, pressure to predict share price movements. Annual incentives at large investment management firms cause fund managers to try to lock in their bonuses, to make short-term investment decisions, and to trade frequently. Average holding periods are now around 8 months. Having a performance fee-led structure avoids the temptation to risk substantial assets. We smaller managers have an opportunity to create organically an aligned LP base. That aligned LP base allows us to buy securities from sellers who are selling for non-fundamental reasons. That could be because they have procyclical investors, and therefore, they're funding redemptions, or because they think the news flow will be negative over the short term. That's because they have 8-month holding periods. Avoid these two situations by having a sympathetic, aligned LP base and the capacity to invest for the long term. Communication style is my final observation. Attention spans in this industry are incredibly short. There's constant competition for attention. When I was writing research on the sell side, no matter how long the research note was, the most important part was a 3 or 4 line eloquent investment thesis on the front. That's what my clients, if anything, read. I have limited time, either on the phone with my clients, at meetings with fund managers, or within the investment bank, to communicate my thesis, to convince other people of my ideas, to have them believe me. In a trading firm in an investment bank, there's a podium with a microphone. When a company reported results or when I wrote a piece of research, I jumped on the microphone. I literally shouted over a massive room of hundreds of sales traders to get their attention. Analysts on the buy side also try to get the attention of their PMs. They have limited time to do this. The typical practice in the industry involves writing monthly letters offering a backward-looking introspection of what happened to markets and why. The letters reduce complex systems to simple eloquent theses. There is a problem about stories in this industry. In life, stories are useful. They help us to make sense of the world. Perhaps you've read the book, Built to Last, by Jim Collins. It's a nicely written, entertaining book in which he dissects the sources of several outperforming companies. The conflation with the historical causality of that analysis with its predictive power would have caused you to potentially make some grave investment errors, because around half of those companies, since he wrote that book, have suffered an enormous fall from grace. Making stories compelling might be entertaining, but it's a barrier to finding the truth. Stories are simple. The world is complex. Stories tend to describe outcomes to talent and stupidity while they ignore luck. The literature refers to this as narrative fallacy. It's our constant strive to attribute a cause and effect chain to historical events. This is useful in everyday life, but it can cause us to think in terms that violate logic. In his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman gave an example in which he posed a question to several participants. The subject of the question was Linda, age 31. She was single, outspoken, and bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice, and she participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. We asked which alternative is more probable? Is Linda a bank teller, or is Linda a bank teller active in the feminist movement? Despite the second alternative including all the information of the first and additional information, therefore being the illogical choice, 90% of undergraduates chose the second option. That's the power of stories. How can we avoid and exploit this? Try to write involved, detailed, long shelf life letters to partners. We investment managers try to create not only an investment track record, but a decision-making track record, a journal of our decisions. Letters can show our current investors and our prospective allocators how we think. They can give them comfort that we're doing what we say we're doing. They can give them comfort that our process is consistent with our stated investment philosophy. There's little value in writing retrospectively about market or stock price movements. It's reductive. Ideally, write infrequently or irregularly. Write when there's something to write about. Avoid pitching. This is incredibly difficult, but write in almost a bland way. Here are the facts. Here are the strands of logic. Here's the data that support a set of conclusions. A reader of those facts, data, and logic, if they come to the same conclusion as you and you presented that information objectively, is more powerful than pitching them an eloquent thesis that leads them to merely believe because of your sales skills. How do we profit from this? Actively seek out stocks with bad stories. They might be opportunities the market is extrapolating from negative news flow. For me, the essence of value versus glamour investing is what James Moncher discusses. It's finding the stocks, the opportunities where the investment merits are attractive, but where the stories and the news flow is negative. The following are excerpts of the Q&A. Participant, Mark, you just started your own fund. What advice would you give to someone who's just starting his own fund? What should he make sure of before jumping into this? Walker, one is to recognize the capacity to do well is limited, so you've got to love this for the intellectual exercise. To build a fund, you need to build an investment track record and a decision-making track record. You need to build trust with a series of hopefully aligned investment partners, and you need to embark on a journey of building relationships with those aligned investment partners. For me, it was important to enjoy that journey and enjoy those conversations for what they were, so that I wasn't going to look back in 5 years and regret having spent all my time in building these relationships. Enjoy them for what they are. When you're a subscale investment manager, the temptation to take on assets through potentially the wrong type of capital is high. Try to be disciplined about the capital you take on, about the claim on your resources those investors might take. Think about what they might add to your investment organization in addition to capital. Some thoughtful investors and family offices have a value philosophy and investment teams who, for me as a single-person investment committee, their time and their intellectual generosity is valuable to me outside of the capital that they can offer me. In the early days, I would suggest any desire to be rich is not a good source of inspiration. You will typically earn a lot less doing this than you can by being part of a large fund. It's a hugely scalable business model. Participant, why did you choose to start your own fund rather than work for a small fund you admired? Walker, what you'll find is that it's important that everyone develops their own investment philosophy and their own principles and process that you think are consistent. No matter how aligned you are with a small fund, there will always be some inconsistencies. Temperamentally, I'm someone who enjoys collaboration, but not a level of forced collaboration. Working in even small teams, I find it can be frustrating for me as a barrier to progress either in the investment management business or in investing in the portfolio. Aside from that, for the type of investing I wanted to do, for the investment philosophy I had, there's an incredibly tiny number of suitably aligned investment firms I would consider. Those firms are small firms with low levels of churn, long tenures of experience, and talented people. Getting opportunities are not always there. Several of my peers are open about the fact they don't like marketing. They're horrible marketeers, and they love business and investment, or they love the practice of investing. I quite like the process of building relationships with potentially aligned partners, of building something, building a brand, building a business, like a project outside of an investment portfolio as well. Participant, I completely agree with your approach about not looking at the market price, the noise, and to completely focus on the business. But then, given that most of the funds across the board are focused on that, how do you suggest we present our facts and figures? How do you suggest we go about it, because not everybody can start their own fund, like yourself, and succeed? Walker, it's not right for everyone. I'm just sharing my experience and the way smaller independent managers potentially have an edge over larger asset managers. There are smaller independent managers that sympathize with this approach. It's about being cognizant of the differences in the investment approach, about simply asking a question in your mind or explicitly to someone that you're interviewing with about how they think about aligning their interest. It's about how they think about decision making, how they think about the elements of the process that are consistent with an investment philosophy. Closed funds are generally more able to do this. They have fewer marketing pressures, and they intend to have a quite sticky investor base. I encourage you to try to find compatible investment organizations to work with, to ensure there's a two-way dialogue in the relationship building process, and that you're not just trying to pitch yourself as a good employee without asking any difficult questions about how they conduct themselves. It took me quite a long time, if I'm being honest, to be introspective enough to interrogate my own personality and temperament. Typically, in the early days of my career, I worked for big organizations, and I was an introvert in an extrovert's business. I was shoehorning my personality into something that would fit the mold of a large organization, adorning this gregarious, charismatic personality and then finding myself in working environments that suit gregarious personalities with open plan, noisy, trading floor environments. I found myself increasingly going to a quiet room to try to carve out time for independent thinking. I'm not suggesting one is better than the other, but a few people are genuinely introspective about what makes them tick and how many people are caught up in this process of building a shiny CV. Warren Buffett refers to this as an inner scorecard versus an external scorecard. The sooner you recognize that, the more useful it is in your career choices. Participant, instead of wasting time trying to get the right price by forecasting, what else do you suggest? What are the tools you suggest we use to make our case? Walker, we are in the business of understanding the long-term prospects of businesses. That is, for us, a forward-looking exercise. When I talk about the value of forecasting, I'm talking about the futility of precisely estimating a complex range of outputs. Rather than build a financial model where, line by line, you're going through volumes, and pricing, and variable and fixed cost, capital intensity, and tax rates, capital structure in 50 different markets for a company, and you're trying to do that on a quarterly basis and getting to an EPS estimate, then you're putting in a multiple on the EPS estimate. I suggest that as a low ROI exercise. I prefer to do a lot of fundamental work to answer a handful of questions. In terms of a business's financial future, I tend to try to understand what I call owner earnings or the maintenance free cash flow of the business. If the business were to stand still today and invest what it needed to invest to maintain its unit output and its competitive position, how much cash can you put in the pockets of owners of that business today? That's a starting point that reflects a normalization exercise of reported earnings. For free cash flow, it reflects an understanding of what the normal working capital intensity or maintenance versus growth capex of a business is. It's a reflection of the cyclicality of the business. That's the normalization process. Then I try to understand the sustainable economic returns on capital and to what extent we reinvest that capital into valuable projects for a long time. If you have these owner earnings of 100, how much of that 100 will be reinvested into projects? What will they earn? Will they earn the cost of capital? Will they earn materially more than the cost of capital? Does the business enjoy lasting unfair advantages offering supernormal high profit capacity and profit sustainability? That ultimately gets me to what is a prospective IRR on an equity investment today. What are owner earnings as a percentage of the market cap? That's the yield. Say that's 10%. Say management will reinvest all of that into projects with incremental yields of 20%. I should be able to get a 20% plus IRR on an equity investment barring any material derailing of the owner earnings of the business. It's a simple framework, but there's a lot of fundamental work required to understand those numbers. If my opportunity cost of investing is, say, 10%, I want something materially higher. Tollymore has a concentrated portfolio. It holds 10 to 15 securities. It has a global remit, so I could invest in 50,000 companies. Therefore, I'm typically fully invested. I don't have cash because I should be able to, at any point in the cycle, find 10 to 15 of these securities with an IRR materially higher than an opportunity cost at any one time. Participant, can you talk about the companies which screen well? They've got great return on capital, great earning growth historically, but, fundamentally, they might be a bit weak. Walker, I don't do a lot of screening. I'm a fan of the opposite of what you were asking about. Companies that might screen well are cyclical companies a lot of the time. Cyclical companies might be cheap when their earnings multiples are high. That's one reason I don't use screens. Cyclical companies have high returns on capital at the top of a cycle, but in the absence of sustainable competitive advantages, those returns on capital revert. That's a value trap. I suggest a good majority of screening based on returns and cheapness throws up those types of companies. It's the corollary I've been interested in, and several companies in the portfolio exhibit, which is companies that screen terrible generally because their reinvestment rates are extremely high. Companies with negative free cash flow but attractive operating cash flow yield and enterprise value are attractive. Their capacity to invest in projects is high. I want them to have as much growth capex as possible if the capital structure of the business can support it. High reinvestment rates can explain why they screen poorly. It could be accounting measures, the accounting treatment of amortization of quasi-permanent assets, for example. It can be the reason they screen poorly and the reason the economic, financial picture of a company is different than the reported accounting picture of a company. We're in a world where you typically see some proprietary screening process. This is how we generate ideas. They look like a funnel. By and large, they're not proprietary, and by and large most people in the industry do screening. Maybe, unfortunately for me, having a more serendipitous process, which is like engaging with management teams, reading filings, engaging with my peers on the buy side and opening myself up to serendipitous conversations with companies and industries, isn't a mechanism to find ideas. That is perfectly fine if you're passionate and competent. It's not marketable, I can't put that succinctly and eloquently on a slide and show it to an investor, but it's a good source of investment edge. Participant, Mark, you spoke about focusing on a handful of questions in an investment idea. How do you get to this handful of questions? How do you identify them? Walker, the difference is they're not the same handful of questions other than when it comes to valuation. I want to understand the normal earnings part of the company. I want to understand the reinvestment rate and the potential economic incremental returns in capital. When I conduct due diligence on a company, I have a number of headings where I go through filings, speak to management, speak to competitors, speak to peers, read industry investing publications, and try to gather facts and data to help me form a conclusion on a number of aspects in a research report. Those aspects are business simplicity. What is the business model? Can I get my arms around this business quickly? Is it complex? Does it have a simple organizational structure? Does it have complicated associates and minor interests? Second, what is the capital structure of the business? How does it finance its activities? What are the uses and sources of capital? Is the capital structure appropriate? Are there a lot of off-balance sheet items? Does it carry the leverage given the recurring nature of the revenues? Another is competitive positioning. Is there evidence for a moat? What are the potential sources of the moat? Is the moat widening or narrowing? Another is growth opportunity, a decent return on investment. What is the addressable market of the business? For how long can it keep reinvesting in projects? Does it have adjacencies it can invest in and expand the addressable market? There's stewardship. How are the decision makers in the company aligned to make decisions consistent with value creation for owners of the company? Is there insider ownership in the company? Does the long-term incentive plan reflect management's ability to make potentially near-term difficult decisions for long-term value creation? Or do near-term decisions make a company's reported financials look weak but create value on the surface? It's a fact-finding mission. I might get to a point where I just don't understand the business, it fails immediately at the business simplicity standard, and I just move on. I might get to a point where I'm uncomfortable with the stewardship of the company or the competitive positioning of the company to an extent that I don't think it's merited to continue doing research. I might get to a point where I write a complete research report and love the company and love the management and its stewardship and its prospects, but the recent valuation, the recent owner earnings yield doesn't give me a good shot at an attractive IRR. Therefore, it might go on a watch list over time. Those things change. Participant, what is the limit to the number of holdings while also maintaining an information advantage? Related to that, how long does it take you to get to know a company well? Walker, it depends. For me, I feel if I have a portfolio of 20 to 25 names, I would struggle to know those assets well enough to make optimal portfolio management decisions. Diversification to me is not a mechanism to lower risk. If that diversification is inadequately resourced, take it to an extreme example. If you're one manager managing a 100 stock portfolio, your ability to know a lot about those businesses is limited. Therefore, your ability to have conviction in what they're worth is limited. Therefore, your ability to act based on share price volatility is limited. In terms of getting to know the businesses, that depends. I've invested after a couple of weeks of work on one business. Some unique circumstances caused the asset to come to market at an unduly distressed level. It was a simple business to get my arms around. Sometimes, like the last company I invested in the portfolio, I looked at it for about 6 months. The stock price declined by about 50%, and I did a little more work. Nothing had changed. It didn't require too much more work before investing in the company. It's unusual for me to go straight into an average-sized position. For me, an average-sized position is 7% or 8%. The smallest equity positions typically approximate 5% unless I feel exceptionally comfortable with the business model. Usually, I invest in negative stories and carry with them the potential for further share price declines. For that reason and because 6 months is still a short time to get to know a company, and because of the long holding periods my portfolio has, getting to know these businesses is important in a multi-year, potentially multi-decade context. As I grow comfortable with the business and its potential and its management, I can potentially increase the size of that holding. Participant, do you go in with your desired sizing? Or do you scale in? How do you do that? Walker, the last portfolio addition was at a 5% position. Participant, did you scale that over time? Or did you just go in? Walker, I went straight in at 5% because it's concentrated, but that's the smallest position in the portfolio. Participant, it doesn't create any market impact? Walker, no. When I say going in at 5%, I'm not necessarily going in half an hour. What I mean is, I'm not going in at 1%, and then a year later, maybe increase it to 3%. When portfolios are concentrated and you have a global or a large opportunity set, the question is this so massively undervalued that it should be in the portfolio? If that's the case, put it in and put it in meaningfully. Or if it is not, don't put it in. Participant, do you lock your investors' access for a period because you're so concentrated? Walker, no. My investors can have access to their capital whenever they want. I don't want to create unhappy investors. There may be external circumstances outside of Tullymore that lead investors to sell positions. I want them to be able to have access to it. There is a process of education and relationship building about the merits of long-term investing, and investors get it. They don't always act consistently with what they say. That's just part of being an investment manager. Participant, you mentioned short attention spans and communication style. Could you give us examples of how you manage to capture people's attention in your letters? Walker, I was suggesting you avoid the temptation to try to grab people's attention. The incentives in this industry are to create sound bites that truncate messaging and communication. They're meant to grab people's attention. The incentive to pitch is overwhelming for investment managers. That is a barrier to good decision making. There's a lady called Annie Duke who wrote a book called Thinking in Bets. She was a professional poker player. I met her recently, and she gave me simple advice about how to make better decisions. If you want to open your work up to intelligent interrogation and analytical inquiry, you should not impart your opinion on whoever is receiving the information. It will influence their perception of the problem. It will make them less inclined to give you their dissenting opinion, which might be valuable. Their dissenting opinion might cause you to do more work. The additional work might lead you to acquire more conviction in your opinion or change your mind. You should be able to change your mind. When I wrote research for the sell side, I created eloquent theses. I'm not saying that's all there was. There was proper fundamental work underlying the research, but the focus was on grabbing people's attention. The focus on the microphone was on grabbing traders' attention. You're in competition with several other sources of stimuli devoted to the goal of grabbing others' attention. I suggest having a self-selection mechanism for the right types of investors by writing involved letters. I have a lot of information on my website. My last letter was 17 pages. I include many interviews, articles, and presentations. Therefore, if I have a conversation with investors who have gone through all that material, that is a higher intention conversation and potentially a more valuable relationship. By making people do the work and jump through hoops, you're almost creating this self-selection solution to creating the right relationships with the right investment partners. Participant, Mark, From the investor's point of view, you've got into a lot of points about what to be wary of. Do you have some red flags when you're receiving pitches or looking at firms for us as potential investors to managers? Walker, here's the barrier. When I speak to investors, high net worth people, their family offices, or their advisors, we have a conversation about the things to look for and how they allocate the liquid public market capital of their portfolios. There are things we have discussed that they're thinking about, like alignment of interest, thinking about under what circumstances the investment manager is getting rich. What are the incentive frameworks for them to make decisions? Do they have someone tapping on their shoulder, warning them that their deviation from a benchmark is not tolerated by the internal risk policy of the company? Technically, they get all this, but my barrier is the IBM effect, or the McKinsey effect. No one will get fired for recommending McKinsey to do a consulting project. If they do a bad job, they won't get fired. If they recommend an unknown consultancy firm, or if the company hires an unknown auditing firm and is a fraud, that person will get into a lot of trouble. If they hire Deloitte, they probably won't. My problem is that even though they recognize a thoughtful way to think about enriching the providers of capital over the long term, and there's a less thoughtful way that is a byproduct of some of these behavioral constraints that we've discussed, despite recognizing that, they're open about this McKinsey effect, the idea that allocating totally more investment partners' capital is a career risk decision for them. It's my job to get their attention and be patient about building a multi-year relationship and trust profile that gradually overcomes that McKinsey effect. Participant, how did you get over the infrastructure barrier? Walker, infrastructure requirements and the compliance requirements are onerous in the UK compared, for example, to the US. My challenge was in trying to develop a proposition and an infrastructure that is the right trade-off between credibility and cost-effectiveness. On one hand, I want quality, credible counterparties. On the other hand, I want to be able to survive as long as possible in a position of being subscale and coming back to not being under pressure to make stressful investment or business decisions about Tullymore and who your partner's with. Tullymore is effectively an appointed representative of a directly authorized FCA firm. That firm has a board of directors with career compliance people who fulfill my regulatory compliance obligations and help me to stay on the right side of the FCA. That's one option. The other option involves hiring a full-time compliance person. That's a costly source of fixed expense for a newly formed independent manager. Another option is that you go down the road of becoming directly FCA authorized, and I will then manage that myself. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't want to be spending all my time managing compliance. The FCA's handbook is enormous. I set it up by outsourcing several operational functions. I have legal counsel, accountants, and a compliance firm. My primary responsibilities are managing the portfolio, marketing the fund, and building relationships with other peers. This is no small undertaking, but it is incredibly enjoyable.